here. It's a pleasure for us to have him, and great privilege as well. And I really don't think he needs any introduction from me. I looked up your CV in Wikipedia. I could give a very long introduction, but I won't. But anyway, he's very kindly agreed to talk to us. He's got a range of things that you can pick his brains about, so I strongly invite you to do so as well. And James, you're going to start off with about sort of 3/4 of an hour, something like that, and then we will take it from there. Okay, so without further ado, welcome and thank you very much for coming.
All right, well, thank you very much, and it's a real pleasure to be here. I'm taking a couple of risks with this presentation. The first one, which I was coerced into doing by Andrea, is to speak on a subject related to the mission of this organization, and therefore in an area where I strongly suspect you know a great deal more than I do. And the second risk was to do so using only one piece of technology in preparation, and that is an instrument which reached its peak of technological development long after it was otherwise obsolete. Not the only thing to have that pattern, as you know, it's the clipper ship phenomenon. In any event, I eschew PowerPoint for present purposes, which also means that although I would be happy to talk about it at later on in the morning, I am not going to give you the presentation that I ordinarily give to academic audiences, which is something more or less directly related to the research that I've been engaged in for the last almost 20 years, namely on the measurement of economic inequality and the implication of the patterns that can be found in the evidence that we have developed on that subject, which I think is a very interesting topic, and which, in fact, early in the research project led me to produce a book called Created Unequal about American pay structures, of which the essential finding was the way in which tech pay in the technology-related sectors had detached itself from the previous sort of Treaty of Detroit pattern of collective bargaining and had become an ancillary feature of the financial markets. Something which I think is very much part of the story of inequality generally in advanced countries, particularly the United States, and part of the story of the relationship between the distribution of income and the crisis. What I wanted to talk about today was something related to the next project, a book which is half completed at this point. The manuscript's in my bag upstairs. It's entitled The End of Normal. And it's a discussion of the financial crisis in historical perspective, and in particular of the of the very disappointing 5 years that have followed the financial crisis, and what lessons we might draw from that experience. And I think, as you undoubtedly know, we are stuck at the moment in a rather hostile and intractable debate between two opposing schools of thought, one of which Paul Krugman describes as the Austerians, whose view is that the crisis continues because governments have not cut enough of their wasteful public spending and their rigid regulations of private markets. And the other one, which is basically labels itself the Keynesian perspective and is advocated most effectively by Paul Krugman, which holds that the crisis continues because governments have adopted austerity and have not been sufficiently energetic in pursuing an expansionary public spending and presumably also reduced taxation policy, deficit spending policy. And what these two views have in common, it seems to me, is a common sense of what the normal condition is at the present moment in time. That is to say, they are judging the performance of our economies against the standards set by the previous 50 years. And particularly in the United States, 50 years which seem, from the perspective of 2000 or so, to have been almost uninterrupted going back to the Second World War, practically forgetting that there was a major uncertainty about the course of growth in the 1970s. But in any event, a habit of thought which projects the previous past growth rate out into the future, calls that the potential rate of growth, projects the previously normal unemployment rate into the future, calls that the natural rate of unemployment, and then expects that the economy will return to that level of performance over some time horizon, typically 5 years in official forecasts. And you're all familiar with this, is what we've seen. And every year, we found that the forecasts do not appear to be met, and every year they simply get rolled forward. But the underlying expectation of the sense of a gap between potential and actual GDP remains the same. And, the manuscript that I'm working on is an attempt to question that, and it has a number of elements of which the question of the role of technology is just one. And so what I wanted to do today was to try to focus, make some remarks about how we think about the role of technology, particularly as trained economists in the modern age. And I may, since my training is now already 30 years out of date, it's possible that I may be mischaracterizing the view, but I think it's worthwhile in any event to try to sketch out for you what I believe the prevailing perspective to be made of, and to remind you of what I'm sure you know, which is that there's a substantial tradition in economics of an alternative perspective. And the argument I will make is that the alternative, older perspective has substantially more to say about our situation than the, let's say, modern mainstream one, and that it's worth considering the implications of that perspective and that point of view. This is particularly related, or the specific point that I want to discuss is the relationship between technology and employment, and technology and unemployment. And I thought I'd just begin by an observation of comparison over a long generation, which is the generations in my family run extremely long periods of time, two or three, I think, of times the average. But it's a curious fact that my father, who was also an economist, as you undoubtedly know, reached the age of 21 in 1929. And just at the moment when his generation in North America, he was Canadian at that time, was about to experience an enormous period of long and deep mass unemployment. So it's interesting to ask, who was it that was going to have this experience? And we know that it was predominantly farm boys. Yeah. These were people who grew up, as my father did, on the family farms of that era. My father actually wrote for his high school newspaper and then for the local press an anonymous column under the pseudonym Plowman. Right? He was raised with horses. So these were people who had a certain body of skills that they had acquired in their youth. They were educated normally, I would say, to 10th grade level. Some had graduated from high school. Very few had gone to college. The mechanical skills of that period were solid but rudimentary, because the machinery available and in use was relative, certainly very primitive by modern standards. And the people in question were, by and large, robust and mostly men, because labor force participation rates for women were by and large, much lower. Not zero, certainly. All of my aunts entered the labor force. One of them went to college, but much lower than today. When we look at the unemployed in today's world, we can see it's a very different population, particularly young unemployed. First of all, most of them are high school graduates, not even near finishers, actually finished high school. Many have at least some college experience. Very few come directly from farms. One might judge that the age of mechanical skills has actually come and gone, that this generation is probably less adept with things like changing carburetors, even if it knows what a carburetor is, disassembling and reassembling them, than the generation of the 40s and 50s and 60s was. On the other hand, there's practically nobody around who doesn't have a set of skills that didn't exist even 50 years ago, 40 years ago, let alone in the 1920s, electronic skills of a rudimentary type, type spreadsheets, communications. And of course, as we know, men and women are nearly equally represented. So we have a sense that technology has not only changed the nature of how of the employed economy, it's also changed the nature of the unemployed economy. And I want to come back to that point. At the same time, we can characterize the causes of mass unemployment in ways which are not dissimilar from that of the 1930s. Now, first of all, it's clear that there is a collapse of demand, even though it's experienced in very different ways. In the 1930s, it was a collapse of agricultural demand relative to supply, or possibly an increase of supply relative to demand. In any event, a collapse of agricultural prices, which was in the first instance what drove people across out of the farm. Also in the United States, we had an ecological catastrophe, the Dust Bowl, which was later realized was due to the mechanization that was ongoing in the 1930s, 1920s and 1930s, digging up the plains and turning the dirt into the sky. And today what we see instead is a collapse of construction, retail shops, again, overproduction relative to markets, but also a collapse of tax revenues, public and therefore public services. Public services, which, or at least great stress on public services, which by and large did not exist at all in the 1930s, in the sense that there was no mass employment in things like public health services, such as we see today. Both episodes show the vulnerability of private finance to euphoria, self-delusion, to fraud, deeply present in the backdrop of the collapse both after up to 1929 and up to 2008. This raises, I think, a question about the nature of innovation. Innovation is always one of the great claims of financiers. That was true in my father's era, as it is in ours, and does raise a question about how seriously one can take that word. It has, it suffuses it. The use of innovation in finance is suffused with an aspect of self-important fraudulence, which is, I think, worth noting. I'm a great fan of Paul Volcker's dictum that the only really important financial innovation in modern times is the ATM, the cash machine. But, of course, the fact that the word is appropriated and misused by one sector doesn't mean that innovation hasn't been the fundamental feature of our era. The question is, what bearing does it actually have on the crisis? Are these simply transformations of form without transformations of quality, or without having a, let's say, an important causal effect on the circumstances that we face? So what's the mainstream answer to this question? My sense is that the mainstream answer to the question, leaving aside the real business cycle model in which there's no crisis at all, if you accept that there was a crisis, the mainstream answer is that there is no influence of innovation as such on the crisis. And that takes two, I think, related forms, that statement. If you look at the canonical neoclassical growth theory, go right back to the solo growth model, where you have y is a function of k and l, each raised to a power, and you have a technology parameter that sits outside of that, and the purpose of that is to demonstrate that technology is neutral. Okay? It is simply something that falls like the gentle rain of heaven upon the earth beneath, and is absorbed by both capital and labor. And it presumably can have a bias, but there's no particular reason to think that it does, that there's all these Hicks neutral and so forth forms of technical change that I remember dimly from lectures that I heard at Cambridge in 1974. In which technology is presumed to at least have the possibility of not affecting the relationship between capital and labor. In that sense, it's an unalloyed good. It enhances, it doesn't distort, and it doesn't destroy. And I think if you look at the work this tradition endures, and if you look at the very interesting paper that first appeared about a year ago from Robert Gordon, a very interesting American economist, who asked the question, is growth over? He didn't spell out a very clear theoretical framework, but I think that he's fundamentally working in this tradition. That is to say, one in which waves of technological change appear as scientific knowledge advances and improve the living standards of everyone without necessarily affecting, for example, the distribution of the balance of power or, let's say, marginal productivities of any particular factor. And what Gordon is arguing is that when he raises the question of whether we are at the end of a period of technology-driven growth, he's making an argument about the solo residual. And his argument is fundamentally that the kinds of technologies that we have around here, up here, and down here, and in here, and God knows where else, all over this place, do much less to enhance real living standards than the technologies that came into use between the mid-19th century and, let's say, the late 20th century. That is to say, such things as piped water, glass windows, air conditioning, of course, the motive power of the internal combustion engine. Okay? And you can make all kinds of quibbles. I mean, what Gordon is doing is something somewhat sacrilegious from a strict neoclassical standpoint, because he's engaging in grossly interpersonal and intertemporal comparisons of marginal utility. It's a complete violation of standard neoclassical precepts. But he's still working within a kind of solo-esque framework in which the function of technological change is to enhance the real character of economic growth. Okay? So that's one way of thinking about the way technology impacts the world. And the second variant, the mainstream view of technology, which emerged in the United States in the mid-1990s, I guess, and it was imposed on mainstream thinking by the observed patterns of change in wage distributions, is this idea of skill bias in technological change, right? Which is another highly developed or anyway constantly repeated mainstream theme. It's not so easy in retrospect to establish exactly how skill bias technological change is supposed to work, but there is, because people who advocate this are very coy about allowing themselves to be pinned down to a specific technology. But the general idea was that the digital age, in particular, has a way of rewarding enhancing the productivity of people who have acquired certain appropriate skills, and devaluing the productivity of people who haven't acquired those skills. And in this model, employment is governed by the supply, relative employment is governed by the supply of skills and by the flexibility of wages. So an outcome of the model was that the allegedly superior employment performance of the United States compared to Europe had to do with the allegedly superior wage flexibility of the United States compared to Europe, and that if you follow this particular formula, it's clear that technology in itself is at fault for nothing. Okay? You can have as much technological change as you like with no effect on employment so long as you're sufficiently flexible in your response to it. That's the, I think, the message of the model. It's only a failure to adjust that can give you the bad result. And I think that's a very familiar policy lesson in the European context. So you have these two mainstream views, and neither of them will permit you to associate technological change with unemployment in any serious way. Well, you step back a century in economics, century and a half, and you find that the intellectual climate is entirely different. As the industrial age dawned, even as thoroughgoing and an upper crust reactionary as David Ricardo in the third edition of his Principles in 1820 admitted in this chapter on machinery that the Luddites were correct, that the effect of machinery was against the interests of the working class. Didn't mean Ricardo was against machinery, but he wanted to admit that it was not an unalloyed blessing. And Marx, of course, developed the Ricardian point. You read chapter 10 of the first volume of Capital, you can see very clearly that Marx saw technology and machinery as a weapon of class struggle. Its entire purpose was to diminish the labor content of output, and to increase the rate of extraction of surplus value. And the examples given in that chapter, which come from the 1830s and 1840s, are still very, worth reading. For Marx, the important thing about machinery was that it enabled you to bring into the labor force people like children and women who required less sustenance and who could be burned out very quickly, died early, didn't make any difference, and to extend the working day to exceptional lengths, while at the same time having no effect on real wages. That was Marx's view of the technological process. And John Stuart Mill who had a very different position in the general class outlook at the time, agreed with him, saying that it's unlikely that machinery had yet at any point lightened the burdens of any human being. More interesting in terms of the evolution of this argument is Schumpeter, who comes along quite a bit later, but has a deep respect for Marx's perspective on technology. Differences are that for Schumpeter, the struggle that technology is part of is the competitive struggle more than it is the class struggle. That is, for Schumpeter, the business of technology is to destroy the previously existing market structures of competing firms. That is to say, to transform the horse and buggy industry into the railway carriage industry, and any number of similar examples. And that was the way in which society progressed. That's what creative destruction is all about. And Schumpeter acknowledged that this had very harsh effects on the losers. Schumpeter's interesting point in his difference of Marx, and I don't know exactly how he justifies it, is that he did not accept Marx's Malthusian view of nominal wages and real wages, and instead expected that the effect of this would be a decline in the cost of living far exceeding any decline in money wages, and therefore a rise in the real living standard of workers. And what he says is the function of capitalism is not to create more silk stockings for queens, but to make them accessible to factory girls for increasingly small quantities of effort. Excuse the politically incorrect gender references, but there it is. That was the way Schumpeter phrased it. In any event, going from Marx to Schumpeter, one has a very clear understanding that technology is a tool of capitalist competition against both inside and outside the firm, and that it has very distinct losers. And then there is also, I think, the interesting observation of Veblen in this, where his chapter on sabotage is relevant to the reaction of workers to the technological process. Sabotage consists of using your sabot, the wooden shoe of the Dutch and northern French peasants, to stick it into the machinery in order to bring the process to a halt. I wrote a book in 1998 that drew on these themes and showed how they manifested themselves in the wage structure and industrial development of the United States in the first period of, through the first period of the digital revolution. It was very clear that what was going on was the beginning of a massive substitution of digital for mechanical and analog processes. Just going back to my father's day, the historical example that's, I think, interesting here, just to tease out these issues a little bit more, and question of the difference between the world in which we, from which we get our ideas, and the world in which we live. I like the example of the rise of the economy of machines and oil. This was in substitution, obviously, for an economy based on animal power. Okay. My father left his farm in Ontario in 1930, took a ferry boat to Cleveland, picked up a Model T Ford, and drove it out to take a scholarship in agricultural economics at Giannini Hall at the University of California at Berkeley. When he did that, one-third of all agricultural land in the United States was in forage. Okay. It was in raising animals, mostly for motive power. Okay. The roads on which he drove that Model T Ford were unpaved from Lincoln, Nebraska to the California line. They were dirt. Of course, over 2 decades, the truck, the car, the tractor would change all of that. Veblen, writing about this, pointed out that the introduction of trucks in the United States was fostered by the lobby of the of Ford Motor Company and its competitors, the U.S. Army, in World War I. He coined a great phrase, which is, invention is the mother of necessity. In any event, a great deal of agricultural land was then freed up for other purposes or fall out of use. What was interesting in terms of the employment effects about this technological change was the extent to which it created a large downstream sector that had never before existed. Right? Which is to say, in addition to the production of mechanical devices, there was maintenance, there was repair, there was fueling, a whole infrastructure, of course, the building of roads, all of which at the time absorbed a great part, or eventually could be brought up to a scale so as to absorb a great part of the labor force that would otherwise have remained on the farm. And I think that experience, which then with the development of the suburban lifestyle and so forth and in the post-war period, gave a generation of economists the view that in general, technologies, even though they may disrupt employment for a time, have the character that they have, they create as many profitable private sector employment opportunities as they destroy. Right? And I think that confidence very much suffused our, at least my view, my generation's view of the process. But there's one detail that's omitted from this picture. What became of the horses? There were no jobs left for them. Okay. So we can pause for a moment and pass in silence over the fate of this unfortunate part of the early 20th century workforce. Admittedly, a few survived in the way fountain pens survive, right, as luxury goods, but by and large, not. So, we come back to the character of the technology boom that we experienced in the late 20th century, peaking in 2000. I said before, it's a quintessence of Marxian and Schumpeterian processes on the face of it. The Schumpeterian processes very much dominant at first, which is to say the introduction of all kinds of new business models, in substitution for previously existing industries, which by and large simply disappeared. And this was part and parcel of the enormous concentration of incomes that occurred at that time. You can track this out in the contemporary United States. It shows up beautifully in the data. A little experiment is to measure inequality across American counties. If I had my computer, I'd show you a graph of this, but it'd be more trouble than it's worth. The pattern of that inequality exactly tracks the census measures of inequality, and it has the nice virtue that you can do a thought experiment or a little mechanical experiment and remove individual counties from the data and ask what would have happened to overall inequality if they had not had the particular income growth that they did have. You take out Manhattan, one county, Wall Street, of that New York, out of the data, the peak inequality is about 20% less than it was between 1993 and 2000. If you take out 4 more counties, you can get the whole rise in inequality in the 1990s down by half. And what are they? Santa Clara, San Mateo, San Francisco, 3 counties in Northern California, and 1 county, King County, in Washington State. Seattle, Bellevue, Microsoft. Okay. That's it. That's half the rise in between county inequality over 3,150 counties in the United States. It tells you that the growth in incomes was extraordinarily concentrated because financial flows were going there, because these were the industries that had the prospect of profit at the expense of everybody else. It was a, needless to say, a gold rush mentality. The overall rise in inequality peaks in 2000 at levels comparable to 1929. And you have the same breakdown in the integrity of business models, in the stability of finance, and ultimately you have the same sort of crash. And then what? After the crash, I would argue you enter into a Marxian phase here. In the sense that while the Schumpeterian phase is at least somewhat abated, if not over, introduction of new technologies and business models, you still have the diffusion of the developed technologies. And they continue to be deployed by businesses all across the economy, businesses that have information and communication processing needs. Okay? And these businesses see the advantage of substituting technology-based, very cheap technology-based capital for labor, given the new infrastructure, in particular, of communications that exists. Okay? And then in 2008, when the efforts to prop up the economy, which were going on for half, 8 years after 2000, fall apart, and I could go into that, there's a purge of labor, as businesses really are forced to do what they didn't wish to do in the immediate aftermath of the technology boom, which is to say they had to cut costs radically in order to survive at all. And in many cases, they failed anyway. And in the aftermath, they have a choice between bringing labor back or bringing or replacing it with technology at a much lower cost. And they'll take that choice wherever they can get away with it. Now, you see this all over the states. Now, I know the situation is here, but you see, for example, drugstores with supermarkets with automated checkout. Right? Where you bag your own groceries, and that, you know, number of checkout personnel goes down correspondingly. You see, I've even seen a restaurant where the menu had become electronic. I thought that was a little bit much. Push your, you know, go to the screen and push the button to make your selections. Okay, that was at a hotel right next to Disneyland, but still, that's... if that's the wave of the future, I'm going to stop eating. Any event, should we be surprised that this has an effect on the absorption of new labor? I don't think we should be surprised at all. I think it's pretty much exactly what the internal combustion engine did to the horse. Right? In the aftermath of the great purge of labor in the 1930s. Right? Just to say, you have a permanent reduction in the available private sector employment, therefore in the absorption of new labor, in the employment-to-population ratio, which has not recovered at all in the United States after dropping 8 points since 2000. And as a result, you have constraints on household formation, income constraints, you have debt constraints on growth going forward. Okay? And what's interesting here is that so far there does not appear to be any downstream sector emerging that will absorb and replace the job opportunities in the private sector. That is to say, there's no computer repair. Software gets replaced, but the distribution of it is basically instant and free. It doesn't involve any new or employment. Very small numbers of people involved in software generation and dissemination compared to, let's say, the maintenance of automobiles. Right? It's simply a process which is not only not labor-using, to so far as I can identify, but also to a substantial extent easily offshored as well, so that the opportunities are much less inside the country. All right. How does it show up in the two major areas that are you know, subject to mass unemployment. I mean, there are differences between the U.S. and Europe as a whole. I think in Europe it's showing up as official unemployment and corresponding cash economy with direct implications for the fiscal crises of the state, right? Which is obvious, and with very big differences between the countries that can handle a fiscal situation that's adverse and the countries that can't. In the U.S., you've got a lot of buffers that come simply from the fact that we have a federal state and a set of institutions that were created at the continental scale in the 1930s and the 1960s. A lot of people take early retirement. Social Security retirement age in the U.S. has moved up to 66 or 67 by now. Two-thirds of Social Security recipients take the early retirement option at 62. And they're gone from the labor force. Medical care, health, federal health insurance, Medicare kicks in at 65. At that point, but anyway, you get an increasing number of people doing that. And the U.S. also has a series of sectors which are labor absorbing, which have not yet been radically cut, although the cuts may be coming. And this is a real difference with Europe. One of them is the healthcare sector, where as a result of the fact that we have a public-private healthcare system, we are wildly inefficient, 17% of GDP. And that has very favorable staffing consequences for employment consequences. The major actual source of employment growth, I think, post-crisis is still healthcare. And it's getting bigger because of the Obama Affordable Care Act. It's going to expand that. There was a very, I think, important Keynesian effect, which needs to be noticed. Higher education, again, a public-private model about twice as big as it is in relation to GDP in Europe, and a vast absorber not only of, it's about 2% as opposed to about 1%, I think, that provides substantial employment, but also it takes a lot of young people out of the labor force who would otherwise be in it. And we have the military, not to be neglected, as a significant source of employment. Then, you know, less attractive, but nevertheless a factor, we have a pretty large prison business. Right? So all of these things, I think, contribute to the fact that the U.S. has got more buffers in place than European societies do. If you take nonprofits as a whole in the U.S., their employment providing capacity is about 8% of the labor force. That's my understanding of the data. Overall, you know, this may well be part of what's been called the narcissism of minor differences. Neither region is going to return to full employment as we previously understood it, on any reasonable time frame that I can see under these conditions. There are structural obstacles to growth, of which this is one, and the others, I think, are resource costs and the complete dysfunction of the financial systems on both continents, which is another set of issues to talk about at great length. But an important implication of viewing things in this way is that the mainstream remedy, which is flexibilization, is exactly the opposite of what is required. Exactly the opposite. That it will have no effect. You cannot drive wages down to make them cheaper than microchips. Just not possible. No point in even trying. Whereas you get Keynesian effects, reduction in incomes leading to reduction in demand and reduction in employment as you pursue that policy. And that's obvious that we're seeing that all across Europe, and we will see it in the United States if the austerity camp wins in the end. That battle is still going on. For the moment, the difference between the two regions is the fact that the U.S. did not fall into a trap of automatic austerity over its entire surface, and so you had stabilization in the U.S., partly for that reason, and partly for the second reason, which is that debts in the U.S. are private rather than public, and household debts over time tend to go down simply because mortgages are either paid or they're defaulted on, whereas public debts which is largely the problem in Europe, are perpetual until they're negotiated. So you have, I think, those two reasons, the main reason why the U.S. has been stable and even growing a little bit from a very low base, whereas large parts of Europe continue to collapse. Does this have policy implications? I would suggest it does. First one I've already said is that one has to be very firm about the... this is really an argument over whether there is a route out by wage adjustment. There isn't. It's not going to lead you in the direction. It's going to lead you, in fact, for reasons I could go into, away from better employment performance. And there's no path out through competitive pursuit of competitiveness. And no path out through more innovation either. Not that more innovation is necessarily a bad thing. But unless you get a credit boom to support it, you're not going to get a major employment result that way. And a credit boom to support it is inherently time limited. This is not a permanent solution. So where I come out of all of this is that the crucial thing is to have an adequate stabilization of incomes and a division of the population in between those who are expected to be working and those who are free not to work, so that you can, in fact, take advantage of what Schumpeter pointed out long ago, which is that the technologies do raise living standards because they reduce the cost of living relative to any given nominal income. And if you can then identify large parts of the population, the elderly, the near elderly, the disabled, the nearly disabled, students who are not required to be actively in the labor force looking for private sector jobs, and maybe you can create institutions that will stabilize provision of health care and education, other essential public services, and provide people to do that, then you can take advantage of the technological revolutions that have occurred. Otherwise, you're going to have a lot of people who are going to end up like horses with nothing to do and nobody, no safety net to back them up. Okay, thanks very much. I said I would do 45 minutes. I did 47 and 23 seconds without looking at the clock.